creating something out of nothing. That is the magic of innovation. You know, something doesn't exist. You imagine it in your mind. You bring it into reality. It's a superpower that all of us have at our fingertips.
Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Hello and welcome to this episode of The Curious Advantage podcast. This series is about how individuals and organizations use the power of curiosity to drive success in their lives and businesses, especially in the context of our new digital reality. It brings to life the latest understanding from neuroscience, anthropology, history, business, and behaviorism about curiosity and makes these useful for everyone. My name is Paul Ashcroft. I'm one of the co-authors of the book, The Curious Advantage. And today, I'm here with one of my co-authors, Simon Brown.
Hi, everyone.
We're delighted to be joined by Diana Kander. Diana is a best-selling author, entrepreneur, innovation consultant, and keynote speaker who spent her career challenging assumptions and asking big, thought-provoking questions. Diana's cracked the code on how curiosity can serve as the catalyst for exponential growth, and she thrives on helping organizations understand that they can get better results if they learn how to ask better questions. Diana, welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're absolutely delighted to be speaking with you today. Diana, you're a serial entrepreneur and you've launched and sold millions of dollars worth of products and services, and you've been helping organizations and individuals to think more like entrepreneurs. Now, we're really curious to hear more about your journey. Could you tell us your story? How did you become a serial entrepreneur?
Absolutely. So I am a refugee from the Soviet Union, actually. I moved to the United States when I was 8 years old. And when we came here, my parents had nothing. They had $267, spoke no English, had no education here. And so they started out with minimum wage jobs working at Pizza Hut and TJ Maxx. And it was very clear to them that they had limited upward mobility on those tracks. And so by the time I was in middle school, my parents started a family business. It was a manufacturing operation that made crowns for people's teeth. And by the time that I was in high school, the business was started doing well. And by the time I was in law school, they had gone from the bottom income bracket to the top income bracket, now employing 15 to 18 people and providing for all those families. And so I caught the bug for entrepreneurship really early on. I saw the transformational impacts of innovation at a very young age. And so I just wanted to be in business as much as I could. And that's where I got the bug. But my parents really wanted me to have a safe career. They encouraged me to get a degree. So I went to law school because I thought that would get me into those business meetings faster. And I left the law firm 12 months into my, you know, 3 years of law school. And then I was a lawyer for 12 months. And I was like, no, I got to go start a business. So my parents were 30 years old when they came to the United States. And at the time I quit the law firm, I was 24. And I gave myself until the age of 30 to try to make it as an entrepreneur. And I came close a few times to not being able to make it. But thankfully, by the age of 30, had considered myself a professional entrepreneur.
Fantastic story. Wow. In that time, what was your favorite part of setting up a business? As you cast your mind back to those early days, what was the most exciting things that you were doing?
For me, the most exciting part is creating something out of nothing. That is the magic of innovation. You know, something doesn't exist. You imagine it in your mind. You bring it into reality. It's a superpower that all of us have at our fingertips.
Love that. I'd like to come on to your writing as well. So you co-authored a book called The Curiosity Muscle. You described that when we talked to you before as a dirty business book, which is a, is immediately intriguing and incites curiosity. If I look at what others have said about it, Dan Pink described it as a fun business fable that will show you how to institutionalize curiosity and avoid the blind spots that trouble most organizations. So tell us what's in The Curious Muscle. And I know it's a little unusual compared to many other books.
Yeah, I created my own category of dirty business books. They're PG-13. They're not like totally salacious. They're not rated R or anything. But I have this philosophy that it's hard to get through an entire business book. For me personally, I'll read the first third and then I'll be like, I think I got the hang of it. And I wanted to, I know there's more good stuff in the other two thirds. And so I wanted to write a book where people were so sucked into the story of the characters and what they were facing that they would read the other two thirds. It's like the fiction is the spoonful of sugar that makes the medicine go down.
Love it.
That's how I help people get through the entirety of the book. I'm happy to chat about different parts of it.
Yeah, maybe the headlines of what you cover as well, because I know you follow a business sort of through. So maybe if you give us the headlines, then we can go a little deeper as well.
Absolutely. So my first book was on launching new products and services, like how to get things off the ground. And then from my personal experience of spending time with a lot of large organizations that were struggling after they encountered success, I learned that it's much harder to stay at the top than it is to get there in the first place. You know, when you're an entrepreneur, you think, gosh, what could be harder than starting a business? And actually, staying successful is much more difficult. Success can actually be the source of a lot of your complacency and getting lazy and losing touch with your customers. And so how do you keep that kind of hubris from negatively impacting your business and keeping you from losing touch with your customers? And that's what the curiosity muscle is all about. It's how to remain curious about your business, about your customers, in a way that allows you to continuously innovate on their behalf and stay relevant.
It's fascinating what you say there, because when you were introducing your story, Dani, you were talking about your favorite thing was the excitement about imagining something new. And then presumably going through that process of, as many entrepreneurs do, of the excitement of building and getting to the point, I suppose, where you feel, as you said, I've set myself a goal of I'm going to make it, which is this getting to some kind of destination. And from what you're saying there, actually, yeah, but like anything, that's just part of the journey. It's once you're there, it's how do you stay there? How do you stay interested? How do you keep your customers interested, engaged, excited? What's been your experience of having those types of conversations with entrepreneurs about, okay, if you've got there, it's not just the end of the journey?
It's hard to have those conversations. You know, I think about it like getting married. For a lot of people, the wedding day is the finish line. And then once you get to that wedding day, you're like, oh no, there's a lot of work to actually stay married. And that's how I feel about it for organizations. It's hard to explain to somebody before they've experienced it, but my specialty today is organizations that are like 100 years old or more, and they understand these lessons very well.
Yeah, I think my wife would agree with you as well on your point there. Now, Dani, in the curiosity model, you talk about how four simple questions uncover powerful growth for us. What's been your research around how asking better questions get better results? And what are some of the questions that you think entrepreneurs should keep top of mind as they're starting to stay curious?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, there's a hierarchy of questions. Like some questions are better than others. And at the heart of the word question is the word quest. So the questions we ask set the journey. They set the frame of what's possible. And so if we can learn how to ask better questions, we can get better results. And that is fundamentally a very important thing for people to believe, to have that kind of journey. For me, there are three kinds of questions that we ask ourselves in business. The first level, which is a very basic level, are understanding questions. It's like the who, what, when, where, and why. Like what's going on in this situation? The second level are reactive questions. These are, okay, well, what should I try? Who else is doing something about this? How do I fix this problem? These are basic problem-solving questions. And then the top level, the one that most of us don't actually get to in business, is called reframing. And that top level is where we step back and say, what are the assumptions that I made going into this problem that might no longer be true? And taking this zoomed out approach on a problem can help us save significant time from going down the wrong road, wasting significant resources. It could just save us a lot of time and heartache. And that is the biggest issue with innovation, both at the entrepreneur level and inside large organizations, that most people don't talk about enough. And that's innovation waste. It's possible to be busy all the time doing stuff that doesn't matter. And so how do we make sure that the time we spend on a problem is actually creating value?
Yeah, we absolutely agree with you there. And we have a model for being more curious. We call it the 7 C's model. And in there, one of the steps is around creativity and all around, you know, how can I ask questions that haven't been asked before in order to spur innovation and be able to then experiment, try things out, come up with new approaches to things, and then, yeah, put those into action through testing out. So fully agree with that. And we've had some interesting conversations in the past also with Lisa Bedell on this podcast, and she talks a lot around killer questions and how to come up with these, exactly as you described, these great questions that really lead to better results because you're asking questions in a better way. So yeah, we fully agree with you, the importance of asking great questions. Your book was all around curiosity. We obviously also see curiosity as hugely powerful. And innovation is your focus area, I guess, through both being an entrepreneur and then some of the consulting that you've done subsequently. What role do you see curiosity playing in that connection to innovation?
I believe that all growth starts with curiosity. It is the foundational element of creation. And I really believe it's difficult to teach people how to be innovative and to put pressure on them to come up with new ideas. But I do believe that curiosity and asking quality questions is a skill set that can be taught and honed. And so for me, you know, if we can get that base level established inside of a company and create some systems and processes that lead to curious actions and behavior and more open minds, then the innovation will follow suit. There's nothing they can do to stop the innovation from happening at that point.
We use our 7 C's model as a way that people can be more curious, I guess. And that goes through from sort of understanding the context that you're in, finding your community that can help you along the way. We have curation, which is around how do you sort of filter out the things that don't matter and focus on the things that are going to be useful. Creativity that I mentioned earlier, which is then how do I bring my own ideas, ask great questions in order to move things forward, put those into action through construction, reflect on that through criticality and check our own biases, and that creates confidence. So that's sort of our way that we describe in the Curious Advantage book to do it. Is there a way that when you're working with organizations, you would recommend that they can be more curious? So questions was one, but are there other things that that you advise them to do that helps them to be more curious?
Yeah, absolutely. The Curious Advantage does an incredible job of setting the type of mindset that's required for people to be innovative in their work. I would say the yes and. I think about processes that we can put on our calendar. You know, if you want to ask me how curious and innovative you're being, I'll say, show me your calendar. Show me the space that you're creating for that reflecting time and those meetings. So I have a certain number of meetings that I think are essential for curiosity to exist in our lives. For instance, I think we have to have pre-mortems on our calendar. Before we start a new project, we have to establish what are those pivot indicators? What are those metrics that are going to tell us if we're going in the wrong direction instead of just following the plan until something hits us in the face and tells us we're going in the wrong direction? I also think that it's essential to have after-action reviews. These are meetings on a regular basis to review how well things are going. After every single keynote that I give to an organization, I have an after-action review where I go over every single slide and talk about what worked, what didn't, what could be better. And that creates an iterative approach to my work that makes it a little bit better all the time. I could give you a couple of more suggestions of types of meetings that we should be having on our calendar that can lead to significant results and continuous learning inside of our organization.
One of the other things, Diana, that I know you talk about when you're talking about what gets in the way of being curious is where people have a fear of failure. They don't want to get involved because they don't think they're going to get back up again if things go wrong. And I know you talk about it in a way, and it stuck with me when I heard you speak around people don't fail very well, just like they don't fall down very well. Could you tell us a little bit about your experience around failure, how people fail, and maybe how they can fail better?
I want everybody who's listening right now to imagine what happens when you trip and fall. And the usual scenario is you'll put your hands out front in front of you and you'll go forward into the stumble. And that is a very dangerous way to fall. That's likely to break your wrist and arms and give you a head injury. And millions of people go to the hospital each year because they don't know how to fall properly. And there's a technique And I learned about this. I read an article about this man who's in his late 80s who gets up every morning and practices his falls and goes to assisted living facilities and teaches other elderly people how to fall properly. And just like our natural instincts cause us pain and anguish, the same is true for failure. All of our natural instincts, when things aren't working out, only increase the pain and discomfort of that failure. And there is a tuck and roll strategy of how to do it to reduce the pain and get through it much faster and also increase results on the other end. So I'll just go through those really quickly. The things that we get stuck in are, number one, denial that the failure is happening. We don't have those pivot indicators or those failure metrics that can tell us when something is going well. Instead, we're stuck hoping for the best and ignoring those red flags. And when those red flags become very apparent that we can't ignore them, we do something that's actually the opposite of what we should do and double down. We say, you know what, I'm just going to work even harder and dig my way out of this hole, burying ourselves even further. This is the largest source of waste in organizations when they double down on a plan that's not working. And then once it becomes very apparent that this is going to fail, we go into a shame stage where we become extremely difficult, hard on ourselves, saying very negative things about our abilities. And then we want to run away from the problem, like hide from it, never talk about this again. And most people miss the essential element of looking through the rubble of what didn't work out to find the assets. And I'm talking about physical assets from every single project that we've done that could be used for something else. And the biggest thing I'll say about failure is nothing is ever 100% a failure or a success. So even when things don't work out, there's always going to be something amazing in that rubble for you to look through.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
I guess from a startup perspective, people get much more comfortable with failure. And you referred to it that, you know, before your success, there were many points where you were close to failure in that. And that's, it's a way of life as you innovate in a startup place. In a large corporate, though, it's very different approach to failure, although there's a huge amount that could be learned from that startup way. When you're working with large organizations, how do you advise them to change that mindset, to reframe that failure and take advantage, as you say, of all that gold that may be in the rubble that is so often left and not talked about rather than mined and shared?
Well, I think that a lot of large organizations are operating under a false delusion that failure is not an option in their system, in their organization. And they want to ignore the fact that it is being operated by human beings. And human beings make errors. That is a part of our lives. And by ignoring that fact, what we ask those human beings to do is hide those failures. You know, try to cover them up, ignore them until they become huge. So one of my favorite failure stories is about a 20-something-year-old that destroyed a huge financial bank because he made a trade that was bad and was trying to cover up his trades by making bigger and bigger bets until he lost so much money that the entire bank had to go out of business. It was like one of the oldest financial institutions in the world because we have such a negative environment where failure is not an option. And I want to go the opposite route. Let's bring out those things that don't work as quickly as possible to minimize the damage of what can be done. And let's stop stigmatizing being human beings and start working on processes. When we out those failures, we can keep ourselves from repeating them over and over again.
You make a fascinating point, because just as organizations have, yes, a fear of failure, but as you say, that they actively often are looking to prevent failure, as in failure is a bad thing. And in some cases, of course, you know, situations, failure is a bad thing. In healthcare, of course, in, you know, travel, if you're flying an airplane, I'm not going to tolerate too much failure.
Of course. Do you know how many people die from mistakes that are being done in healthcare every single year? Like a significant number of people die. And if we pretend like it's not happening, we're never going to fix it.
That's right. And as you say, you're getting in the way of what in the end is a very human, we're dealing with human beings, right? And human beings are naturally going to make mistakes. So we're setting ourselves up naturally to fail. The other thing that human beings do, and we do it as best we can working not to do this, is we have our biases, right? And this is something we talk about in The Curious Advantage as well, as when we're being curious, something that really can get in the way of being successfully curious is around our biases and not being critical of the things that we're exploring and stepping back and go, am I just going down the same rabbit warren? Am I still just doing the same things I always did before? Am I talking to the same people? What's your view on biases, and from entrepreneurs, from businesses, and from just people trying to grow? How do biases get in the way?
One of my favorite things about biases is that the higher your IQ, the more biases plague your life, which is a very counterintuitive way of thinking about it. The smarter you are, the more likely you are to fall prey to biases because you think you're so smart, you can outthink it. And even if you know that biases exist, you cannot prevent them from affecting you. It's like trying to be mindful of breathing through your nose while you're sleeping. That's how powerful these effects are. So the only way we can keep biases from affecting our work is by creating guardrails, like the kind that they have in a bowling alley, you know, for you to put on the sides to keep you from going into the gutter. And those guardrails are processes that you can establish in a project that are meant to protect you from you. Don't try to will your way out of it. It's like putting a cupcake in front of you and trying to keep from eating it, you know, or something delicious that you love. Instead, put guardrails in to make sure that you don't fall into that temptation that all of us fall into.
What would be an example of a guardrail?
So we talked about a pre-mortem, something to establish before we start a project. And one of the processes inside that meeting is to establish your pivot indicators or your failure metrics. These are something that you're going to measure during the project that will let you know that you should try something else. All of us start a project with success metrics. Like these are the best case scenario of what's going to happen in the project. But not enough of us answer these questions. How will we know if it's not working? And when will we know? And in order to answer those two questions, we usually end up measuring something completely different than our success metrics. And we could know much sooner than we would with success metrics. And those are the kinds of guardrails, rather than leaving it up to yourself to say, is this project going well? I'm not sure. You know, and especially in large organizations, the projects are 2-3 years long. How could we know 3 months in if we're on the wrong track? And there are few projects where those metrics are not available.
Yeah, it hadn't even occurred to me this, that of course we will define critical success factors. We don't define critical failure factors.
Great idea. Yeah, there's some actionable points definitely we can be taking away from this. Danny, you've already written 2 books. I believe you're working on your next one at the moment around B2B pitches, I think.
Yes,
maybe
that's right.
You can share a little more on what we have in store when that one comes out.
It's a little bit different take on curiosity, but how to be more curious about the impact that you have on others when you're pitching an idea or yourself to an audience. Most of us think about what it is that we want to communicate during our pitch. We try to be really impressive and communicate our expertise and our ideas, and we're not thinking enough about the emotional impact of the message. And that is the key to it actually resonating. So one of the most amazing pieces of information that I found out was an hour after this podcast or a keynote or any kind of presentation, people will forget 50% of what they heard.
Yeah.
A week after the presentation, they'll forget 90% of what they heard.
The Ebbinghaus forgetting curve. Yes.
Yes. And yes. So how do we control the 10% and not leave it up to chance? And how do we expand on that 10% and create the kind of presentation that is memorable and actionable? And that requires a lot more curiosity than most people are putting into their presentations. And I think it can make a huge difference for organizations.
Fully agree. In fact, I have post-its stuck all over my monitor with various bits of guidance and things, and one of them that looks like it's fallen off at the moment, but it has, how do you want people to feel exactly to that, that it's when you're presenting or when you're trying to share a message, you know, what's the feeling you want someone in to come away with? What's the emotional impact, the emotional connection that you want to have? So fully appreciate that message.
Can we talk about you for a moment, Diana?
Yeah.
What are you personally curious about at the moment?
The list is long, but it's mostly on how to be a better parent. I have a 1.5-year-old and an 8-year-old who's almost 9. And, you know, the older kid who's almost 9, that has gone from like physical warfare as a parent to psychological warfare. And I am learning the skills of how to communicate with your kid and teach the kinds of curiosity and innovation skills that I would love for him to have later on in life without driving myself crazy in the present.
I love that. I have to be honest, I'm going through the same process. And when you talked about the guardrails in the UK, I think we call them sort of the bumpers that you put on down the bowling alley. My experience, because I have a son that's becoming a teenager, and my experience of working with a teenager, my experience of one, is that the goal is to continue to widen out the guardrails in a way that's safe for them, right? And you know when you get it wrong, when you've set the guardrails too tight because they don't have bounce off those bumpers and you just don't want to set them too wide and they fall in the gutter, right? It's a learning journey.
It is, you know, the most meaningful startup I have ever been a part of, and everything changes all the time. So it's very important to stay curious.
Do you have perhaps a definition of curiosity? It's something we ask every guest. There's no right answer, but we are always curious as to how you would define curiosity.
Yeah, it is the space between what you currently know and what you don't know. And most people walk around every day with no space in their daily life, right? Like they have a to-do list. They know what they need to do. And it is only when we create that space in our lives, and I believe that happens on your calendar, that you can actually, you know, reflect on what's going on, find opportunities to do things better. But it's all about creating space in your life to look at that additional perspective.
I like that very much.
And again, an actionable one that actually, if we want to be curious, maybe we just need to create more of that space on our calendar to be able to reflect upon that gap between what we know and what we don't know. Maybe an opportunity for you to ask us a question, Diana. So one of the things we've been doing recently is throwing it open to say any questions for Paul and I that you'd like to ask.
You know, I'm always curious, what is the biggest challenge in communicating these ideas inside organizations? What is the biggest roadblock that you face?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think probably two things. So one would be around, I don't have time to be curious, or I don't have time to learn. And yeah, we're all living very busy lives. There's always hundreds of things competing for our time, and therefore trying to create the case for why curiosity is important, why curiosity matters, why we think it's the greatest sort of advantage available in the digital age. So that's a constant one, I think, of creating that time. That would certainly be one. I guess then the second is sort of what we can actually do to be more curious. So actually putting it into practice. And I think actually some of your actionable suggestions are really useful today as well, and trying to get that message over. And that's really where we came up with the 7 C's as well, of trying to provide some actionable ways that people can be more curious and understand what we mean by curiosity.
And how do you answer the time question?
A mixture of ways, and a lot of this depends on who you're talking to as well, because different messages will resonate with different people. There's an element around prioritizing actually your own development and prioritizing your own learning, that we don't have time essentially translates into actually I've prioritized a whole bunch of other things ahead of this. And therefore, you know, how do we move it up the priority list? And there's many arguments, and different arguments will resonate with different people, whether it's at an individual level, actually prioritizing my own skills so I can perform better, or so I can have better relationships, or whatever it may be, is the thing that improving my skills will enable. if it's from a business perspective, it may be around expiring skills and the need for innovation and the need for coming up with new methods, new ideas, new questions, experimenting, exploring, all of those things, you know, we need to prioritize and create time for. If we're not curious, we're not going to be doing all of those things. So yeah, the message is different depending on who the stakeholder is, but essentially around creating a case for why we should prioritize greater curiosity or learning.
Amazing.
And the one I'd add, Simon, if I may, is it's around culture, but it's the expectation gap between leaders and managers. Typically, you think, yeah, I'm pretty curious and I'm pretty good at encouraging curiosity in the organization. And if we ask the people that work for those leaders and managers, often you get a different answer. And there's that gap of perception between, you know, really, are we curious and am I okay to be curious in the organization? And it's one of the reasons why we've been working with the business called Holt Ashridge on a curiosity diagnostic, which is currently coming out of beta testing and will be launched, depending when this podcast goes out, soon or already launched. But that's really going to start to look at what are some of the enablers of being a curious organization and what are some of the things from a leadership point of view, culture, technology, and so on, that help us be more curious within organizations. So we're really looking forward to that.
That's fantastic. I can't wait to check it out. If you will permit me one more question, I don't want to take over your interview, but I am like a squirrel for good questions. And so I'm always on the lookout for a great replacement question. So something that people are currently asking, and you have a good substitute for a better question that can really improve their results. Do you have any examples of something you try to teach people?
Oh, no, that's a great question. It depends on the context, but one that is helpful that I use would be to sort of project into the future, project what success looks like in the future, and then sort of ask how we got there. So in the context of learning and leading a learning organization, it might be, so 3 years' time, we're recognized as the number one learning organization in the world. What were the things that we did in order to get there? Or, you know, what does that success look like? So different versions of that question, depending on the situation, but some sort of projection of greatness in the future, and then asking, you know, what people to visualize, you know, what we did to get there, or what that looks like.
Awesome.
For me, I think that we fully agree with you. It's not just about asking questions. It's really about the quality of the questions, right? And certainly asking open questions that create options work, you know, asking people, what excites you? You know, what are you working on? Just what's on your mind? You know, have you wondered why? These sorts of open questions that provoke people to reflect and think, I think we find tends to have good, you know, good results as well.
The other one that's very helpful is the sort of, what are we missing? What's not being said? Those types of questions as well. So creating the psychological safety to have the alternative view. It might be, you know, if we were playing devil's advocate, you know, what would be the alternative view to this? So those types of questions that allow for an alternative set of thinking or curiosity in coming from a different angle into things.
Terrific.
Great question, Diana. Great question. Diana, it's been a wonderful conversation. As we wrap and look to close, sadly, our conversation, if there's one thing you would leave our listeners with today, what would it be?
You know, the worst possible thing we can do at work is to get more efficient at things that we should not be doing in the first place. And so how do we create the kind of space to figure out if what we're working on is actually creating value in our organization and if there's a better way to do that? I think most of the time when people think about innovation, they think about disruptive innovation, you know, significant changes to our work. And the vast majority of what even the most innovative organizations do is that everyday innovation of improving the things that we do and stopping the things that we should stop. And by focusing too much on the big I innovation, we miss the opportunity to significantly improve our work on a daily basis. And the questions we ask of ourselves and our teams are the key to making those changes.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you. I'm sure Simon has loved this conversation. It's been wonderful talking to you about the curiosity muscle, about how to keep the hubris, how to ask these better types of questions, like the understanding questions, the reactive questions, the reframing questions, the real practical things you talked to us about, pre-mortems, after action reviews, having failure measures, which is a new one for me as well, and something that I am going to start to do with my teams tomorrow. It's fantastic. And personally, I loved your definition around curiosity about making the space between what you do know and what you don't know. It's been a really wonderful conversation, and we are so grateful for you to join us today and speak with us, Diana. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Curious Advantage podcast. We're curious to hear from you. If you think there was something useful or valuable from this conversation, we encourage you to write a review for the podcast on your preferred channel saying why this is so and what you've learned from it. We always appreciate hearing our listeners' thoughts and having a curious conversation. Join today at #CuriousAdvantage. Curious Advantage book is available on Amazon worldwide. Order your copy now to explore the 7 C's model for being curious. Subscribe today and keep exploring curiously. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast.
The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon.
Stay tuned for the next episode and keep exploring curiously. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.